All right, it's our pleasure to welcome Carl Ferrick Weston for the next talk. He's the director of the Laboratory for Mathematics Imaging at the Brigham and Women Hospital at Harvard University. CF has contributed a lot to the field of diffusion MRI processing and also segmentation and registration of all of those modalities, MRI, CT, ultrasound, and so on. And today he's going to be talking, I think, about tractography. So please, CF. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Christoph. Is it loud enough? Can you hear it in the back? So we saw this morning a nice slice of diffusion MRI analysis, kind of from how you get the data to application. And I'm trying to get a view of, we want to slice in the other directions. I mean, we want to look at tractography methods and compare them and see if we can do some conclusion in the end. I'm going to give a very short background diffusion because we had a nice one after Christoph, just to have everyone on the same page. And then I'm going to go through different types of methods. And I divided into four different types. I call them geometric methods, stochastic methods, physics-based methods, and global support and atlas-based methods. And then in the end, you can see we can make some conclusion where the field is going. And I would love to have some input from you also on that. I think that the trend still is that we are diverging. We're doing more and more new methods, and we're not really collecting from experience and trying to make something that actually converges to one good method. So we are measuring diffusion in the brain, and this is a good illustration of what anisotropic diffusion is that Gordon Killeman has done. On the left, you have a piece of Kleenex. If you put the pen there, it's going to diffuse isotropically because of how the grains are laid out. If you compare to a newspaper, which actually has a grain in one direction, you're going to have this faster diffusion in one direction. And as you can see, it can be represented by an ellipsoid fairly well in this case. And tractography is basically tracing along the maximum diffusion, and it could be through a tensor model or something else, but that's kind of the idea of tractography. We have to keep in mind, though, that what we're looking at are the axons, and they're quite small. They're order of micrometers, and have the pointer here. I can use it. So we have the axons. So the diameter here is maybe 1 to 10 micrometers. It depends on where in the brain you look, and tracking these tiny axons from the cortex down here, for example, in the corticobasal spinal tract, is of course very difficult. And thank you. And I kind of want to compare it with the highway. I mean, it's very hard to track individual cars here, but somehow we can see the trend. And if you have enough fibers that are coherent, we can do measurements here, even if the boxes are like 1 or 2 cubic millimeters. But as you see here, it's a several magnitudes of order here. So through voxels, we maybe have 100,000 fibers passing through. So to think about these tracks actually as streamlines through this, they're not axons, but it's very tempting to look at them as the tracks. And as we've seen this morning also, that we have different areas. In the corpus callosum, it's fairly easy to see these highways. We have coherent fibers here. But when you come to these areas here, you have crossing fibers, and it's quite complicated, and especially with the diffusion tensor model, we don't have enough information to see where we should go. So that was a very short background. So I'm going to then look at these four different types. And here is a little bit a figure I've done. I tried to put some of the most common methods in this. So we have geometric methods up here. With them I include streamline tensor methods, both tensor-based, or if you have Hardy data, or two-tensor model. You also have this fast marching type or evolution schemes. So they are geometric. You look at a metric and you try to find the front. There are other methods that looks in the neighborhood to get support, because making a decision in one box is sometimes a little bit too noisy. We have another class called stochastic, and we have different ways. So we have non-parametric methods like bootstrap. We have Bayesian approaches that are kind of gained a lot of appreciation lately. There's some based on particle filtering. We have another area which I call physics based, and for example, you can model the diffusion equation directly, or an optimal pattern analysis, or use some flow based methods. The last one I call a global model support and atlases. This is a little bit empty at the moment, and we can maybe discuss why. So, but some of these methods here, like the Riemannian methods, are global in the sense because actually finding the global closest path. So even if they're geometric, they have overlapping features with this global support. And that's why all these different types actually have put them overlapping, because they have different, for example, the streamline already have some probabilistic meanings, as we talked about this morning. Okay, so let's start with the geometric methods and see what you have. So I divide them into two parts, where the streamline methods, and this based on a local metric. The simpler ones, first of all, I say there are many methods have been published maybe the last 10 years, and actually, I think one method that predates most of the literature in detailed cryptography is something that was done in the DTK software package. So this is a visualization toolkit. That's from the visualization of the streamline methods have been used for many, many years, maybe two decades. And I think there's a method of 93 that was actually implemented in DTK. And a lot of the work done in our field kind of has disregarded this field. It's kind of parallel developments. But there are a few nice reviews if you want to see a complete list of the history, and there are quite a lot of material. So how does it work? And there are, when you do performing streamline cryptography, to find the major diffusion direction in some way, and then say that this is the tangent to the curve. And then we have to integrate all these tangents to a path, and there are different ways to do that from numerical methods. The simplest one is called the Euler method. It's simply to step along the tangent. It's a very simple and fast method, and some of the early ones use this type, and I think the FACT method, that is also more one of the most used methods, actually is very close to an Euler method. The second Euler method is maybe the most common streamline implementation. And here you use a midpoint also, so it's a little bit better estimation of this tangent. And then you can go to fourth order, and then you do a weighted average of four estimated tangents. But if you implement something today in streamline, you're probably going to look at something like this. This is the most common one. Going to fourth order, I haven't really seen that it actually is helping a lot. And this is the result, so I think second order going cut that. And as you see, we can get fairly nice pictures from this is clinical data, 2 by 2 by 2 millimeter. But again, these streamlines are not axons, even if it's very tempting to look at them as axons. So what about crossings? We have talked about this a little bit. So this is complicated. I mean, it's complicated to find the invalid cars, but even when you have crossings, it's even worse. And the standard tensor model does not handle this in a good way, and this is a very simple illustration why. We have anisotropic tensors along the tracks, but when they mix, you have this kind of averaging of the signals, and you don't really know in which direction you're going to take while you're going through the crossings. It's kind of undefined. And this is a reason why these Hardy methods have become popular in the last 5 years. So this is high angular resolution diffusion imaging, and one reason it took some time to gain popularity is you need a lot of data, it takes time, and the scanners are now better to do this, so you can do a full brain a decision in maybe 5 minutes, and also with parallel imaging we can get much less distortion, so we can actually get pretty good data in Harding, so maybe fix the directions in 5 minutes. And here if you have a crossing tract you're going to get two peaks on this orientation function on the sphere. And as Christoph described this morning, the hardest signal you do this cube or transform, integrate on the sphere to get this signal. So this slide is from Maxim Dekotov's thesis. He also shown that if you do some of the convolution and sharpen this, you can do a better job on defining these tracts. And he also talks about a little bit how this connects to probabilistic tracking that I'm going to talk about later. Because this can really be seen as a distribution of the sphere. But the way it's derived here, it's a geometric solution. Another way to do this is, so if we now have crossing tracts and we say we have two tracts maximally, we can actually fit more than one diffusion tensor model there. So this is an example of the normal tensor model in this area of the brain, so corpus callosum. And we see these large tracts coming down here. And then in the crossing areas, you have some of these mixed round tensors. But if you instead fit two tensors, you get something like this. And we can then follow the large tract here and some of the other tracts coming in. So this is a little bit different from what we saw last slide. That here, this is not the parametric description. It's just a sample from the sphere. It could be 50 samples or 100 samples. So these peaks you have to find some way, and that's not trivial, and there are methods coming out how you find these peaks. But if you do a more model-based fit, so you actually have two tensors here that you fit, which is not trivial to how to do that robust, you can again look at the eigenvectors and find these directions. And one reason we did this is we're working with the neurosurgery department at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and so Lauren O'Donnell is there as a postdoc. And she's going to talk this afternoon a bit more of other work we've done. But the problem we have there is that if you do normal tractography here in the corpus band tract up to the motor areas, you tend to favor the big highways, as we say. I mean, you can find the big structures, but we know there are motor fibers going out to other parts. So what you see here is activation from fMRI if you do leg movement, hand movement, and face movement. So these are motor areas. They should be connected down here. But since we have these major tracts here, you're kind of stealing the show and the tracts only go in that direction.
So, I mean, this does relate to what Laurent asked about, and right, I mean, it sort of illustrated that, that's your point, that the major tracts are sort of grabbing solution because it's more.
So I think one part is just a resolution reason, because the other tracks might be smaller, and the other one, we have a bias towards the larger one, because they're
over there. And
yes. So we did one attempt using this two tensor model, and there have been other studies using stochastic tractography that I'm not going to show, but it's the same idea. You want to try to take other pathways, not only the strongest one. And in the two tensor case, you have two directions all the time, and you're going to pick the one that is closest where you come from. But you see, we reach these areas now a little bit more, but it's very hard to validate if these tracks are real. I mean, but you see we get more tracks, so this is at least indicating that something in the right direction is happening. But if these tracks really are valid, it's very hard to do a study with that.
Carl, so you're actually modeling at that location a mixture?
In every location.
Oh, in every location.
And I think we have some measurements. If it's too much like a tensor model, we keep the tensor model. Otherwise, we try to fit. Actually, we do it during the tractography, so it's not. You don't pre-compute two tensors everywhere. You do tractography. You estimate from the diffusion weighted images a two tensor model, and you continue like this. It's inside the tractography method.
But what are you doing exactly? You're branching everywhere. Don't
seem
to have that many branches.
So we don't branch. So it's just that if you have something starting this direction, it actually is allowed to continue if there are two tensors. But if it's only one tensor that is stronger, it's going to steal it and kind of turn it.
Okay.
So.
Just
there's no branching, and that there are other methods that do branching, and it can be discussed if that's a good or bad thing. But if you have fanning structures, I think branching could be useful. But if you have divergence, yeah. But I think some of the cubo methods will have the same, can do some of the, I mean, this is really a limitation of the tensor model, and some of the stochastic and the cubo will also have this behavior. So that was the first, which I mean, normally called the streamline methods. They are fairly deterministic in the way you work with them, and local. You make local decisions all the time. And that's one reason that people sort of look at these fast marching methods and the level set methods are a little bit more global, and you minimize the global energy. And so Parker, he did some work, I think around 2000, ISMR in the first paper, and then there's a TMA paper 2002, how to do a fast marching approach using this diffusion data. Normally, when you have a fast marching, like Oshet-Satyan style, you have a local cost function which is isotropic, but it has different strength. So it's a conformal metric. You don't have a direction there, but it says how fast you should go. And Parker puts some vector cost in this, depending on the direction of the diffusion tensor. And if you start here in the corpus callosum, you get this kind of time of arrival map. So I think bright here is early time, and then you have darker. But as you can see, it's kind of quite blobby, and I think it's related a bit to what we're talking about, is the geodesic direction we want or not? Because the data is not as sharp as we need it to really follow. And here are examples of, so this is an early results from Parker, 2002, so they have done more work since this. But you can see it actually takes pathways if you see the points that are not really correct. I mean, some of them are. Then after using this kind of conformal plus a vector term, that we did some work in the Riemannian that also we saw this morning. And so instead of having then an isotropic metric here, we have a Riemannian metric. And as Christoph described, if you invert the diffusion tensor, we can measure distances that become short along the pathways. And this is an example of like equidistant circles. So so these are circles in a normal metric, but so these are equidistant lines. So in the corpus callosum, the shortest path will go along this way. And this is a color coding if you take the ratio between the Euclidean length and the geometric path. And so this was a very early implementation. This is almost like a Dijkstra-like implementation. We tried to do an anisotropic fast marching, and it's somewhere between Dijkstra and fast and the fast marching. It's actually very hard to implement this in a stable way, and that's one kind of reason that Christoph did, that he found a good method to do this. I mean, anisotropic fast marching is complicated to do well. And so you have to be very careful when you do these implementations, and you can read in his thesis more. So this is a picture from Christoph's thesis. And I want to comment on this a little bit, if the geodesic path actually is the direction of the fiber. And if you look here, I mean, even the corpus callosum, you normally, there are very kind of parallel bundles here, but I think you can see a slight kind of fanning. And I think that's, is attributed by this, that you actually are cutting the corners a little bit, because the diffusion tensors are not sharp enough. The cost to go across the fibers are not zero. So you can actually, it's just slight, and it might not have a big impact on the result, but I would like to see these fibers a little bit more parallel. So I think it tends to cut corners, because it's not, the cost to go across the fibers are not zero. And you cannot really make them completely isotropic, anisotropic, because you cannot invert them. Another work using similar style, just a metric, is by Tom Fletcher and Tao Jiang and Ross Whitaker in Utah. They're actually doing something that is quite interesting. If you have this map here, you have a seed point here. If you do another map by, say, seeding up here, and you add those maps together, you're actually going to get a valley in this map that is kind of the closest path. And maybe take some time to think about it. If you have two of these weird maps and add them together, well, why does it make sense? But it actually gives a quite interesting result. Because if you are here, and you have found the closest path from one way, it's the closest path from both directions. So you're going to get this valley of a constant number. And if you then threshold these valleys, you can get like a volumetric result here. So, and another thing they have done is to implement this on the GPU, on the graphics card, on the computer. So this is actually quite fast. You can get results. I don't know if I can say in real time, but it's interactive in some sense. And compared to when our implementation here, 2002. I mean, it took probably 2 hours to generate this one slice. I mean, to do this efficiently, it's complicated. Okay, so that was the last example of the Riemannian metric. As we saw earlier in my talk, that the tensor model is not great for crossing the more complex fiber structures, and could we somehow put this into the metric if you want to do similar style? And there is theory called Finsler geometry that is actually a generalization of Riemannian geometry. So instead of having this elliptic cost function, the Gaussian kind of radial angular radial, you can have more complicated functions. And they have some properties that they're called Finsler metrics, and for me it was a bit surprising that this could actually work at the triangle in quality area, but this metric can have quite weird shapes, and it still is a real metric. We did some work with Derek Pichon, the student of Alan Tannenbaum and Mikai, and we didn't know about this Finsler, but we had a Hungarian resolution evolution scheme. And we saw that we could get better connectivity using higher B values, which is the same as you see in the cue ball imaging. And this is using a Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman approach, and this is something also that Christoph has extended later. So this is an early examples of this using the Finsler metric. So. Another student of Alan Tannenbaum, John Melonakos, has continued to work on this, and he actually figured out that this was a Finsler metric, and they have a nice PAMI paper now that is out this year or previous last year. And so they have re-implemented some of the code from Eric Pichon, and another thing they're using is they're using anchor tracts. So here is an example of the singular bundle. It's a bundle that goes around the corpus callosum. It's a very thin bundle, and if you do tractography, you tend to not curving enough, so you kind of have a bias of going outside. And here's an example. Instead of following the single bundle, you miss a little bit here. This has streamline errors, and this is because of how you integrate during the streamline seeding. This is just an example of how this evolution scheme looks. So instead of having a Riemannian metric here, you have a function that it depends on where you're on the curve, but also on the tangent direction of the curve. And so if you look in PAMI, I think last year, there's a nice paper by John and Tannenbaum and a few others. What they then do after they find this kind of anchor track to do a level set to kind of find where the boundary is. So they start with finding the closest path, which is just a path here, and then they do a level set evolution to grow it, so you get the edge of the track. Okay, so that was, we've done some of the streamline technology methods. the fast marshaling Riemannian Winsler versions. I would now like to jump to the stochastic methods, and there's actually quite a lot of work there done, and I have not been able to put all the references here, but here's a few of the early ones. So Lazar, Alexander, ISMR 2002, Dave Tuck did also something in the ISMR, but also his thesis is a good good source of this type of work. And we did something also in 2002. The idea here is that you have a distribution of fibers, so instead of having one, if you see there one tract, you see it many times, and this distribution somehow describes the tract or the uncertainty of the tract. So that's one of the advantages with the stochastic method. You can somehow get a handle of the uncertainty, and which is important when you do studies later on. The non-parametric approach using bootstrap, something from Peter Bass and Pajevic, Jones and Pier Paolo, and also Lazar and Alexander. A drawback with this non-parametric method that you need a lot of data. Normally you acquire a data set and then you acquire it again and again, and then you have a collection of data, and then you can do these bootstrap approaches, but you get very long scanning times. So another way to do it is use a parametric approach, and this is where the Oxford group has been pioneers. So Tim Behrens had a paper in 2003, how to use a Bayesian approach to this, and we did some work in 2005, and then the Oxford group had a new paper, very nice, in 2007, that extended this to a more global tractography. So I want to say a few words of this, how this works. So instead of having a tensor in each voxel, we have this kind of distribution on the sphere. And I'm going to say a few words how we estimate this. But in this distribution, for example, here in a well-defined tract, is very sharp. So there's no uncertainty where you go next. In a smaller tract, you have more uncertainty. And in the gray matter, or close to them, you have a lot of uncertainty. And then you do very similar to like the streamline tractography. You seed and you go in the direction where you have the peak, or you draw a sample of the distribution and you step in that direction. You come to a new distribution, you do a new sample and you go in this direction. And then you do this for the full tract, and then you do it again and again and again. So you get the distribution. And in areas where you have a wide distribution on the likelihoods, you're going to get a big spread. And so this is another way to see the formulas here. So we have a likelihood function, which is the one I showed you, and you can put a prior, and this can count if you know something from the data from an atlas, but normally we only use a prior where we're coming from. We know the tracks cannot turn very quickly, so you can have a prior on the direction, and I think here we have like a cos square, cos to the 4 function, a very smooth function. And then you multiply them and you get the posterior, which is actually the one you draw from. The contribution here that Ola Freeman did was that he found a very fast way to implement this, and the reason it's fast is the way he defines the model. So this is the normal tensor model. You have this Stegel-Tanner equation that Christoph showed this morning. If you constrain it with two parts here, one isotropic part and one isotropic, so it's a product here of two exponentials, you get the model that it goes from isotropic to complete the isotropic, but it doesn't go through the planar version. It's a constrained model. So this is not the sum of two compartments, it's this product, and that's why it's easy to estimate the parameters. And so this is the model again, and the parameters you can actually get from the tensor directly. I'll show it in the next slide here. You have a symmetric matrix here, and we want to find the closest symmetric tensor that has the two smallest eigenvectors equal, because as you see here in the first, all these have the two smallest eigenvectors in the same, that's why it's cigar shaped. And to find to show that this is the closest, it's actually, it's not trivial. It took some time before we could prove that, but it's kind of intuitive that you would average the smallest and the the second smallest. And then from, so actually, so we use the tensor model to get these parameters, and then we put it into the model. So what happens then if you have crossing tracks? This model is very simple. I only have one fiber direction. But still, we can model more than one event. And what happens is the mismatch results in increased uncertainty in the plane of the crossing. So the way you create this likelihood function, you test your model in the data, and you get a value. And you move your model, and you move it in all directions. And then where the model fits along the tracks, you're going to get high values. And between the tracks, you're going to get smaller values. But in this plane, you get fairly high values, you can see here. If you have a prior of the direction, if you come from this direction here, this prior is going to then help you by removing the other peak. So the posterior is going to have an uncertainty in this direction, but it's only going to have one peak. So how do we then go from all these tracks to probability of connection? And there are different ways to do this, and this is the simplest way is just to count how many times the track passes a voxel. So I mean, the green one here has crossed 3 times, and the blue one has crossed 2. And the most simplest way is to do that in the whole volume. To do this correctly, you have to be a bit more. How you normalize this is a bit trickier, because you really want to normalize the length. All the paths with the same length should add up to 1. So just taking all the boxes divided so they sum up to 1 is not correct, but I think that's fairly common that people do that. But to do carefully, you have to then normalize every length with the same length to 1. Here's an example. You see it in the corpus callosum. And most of these fibers are correct. Sometimes it jumps to other tracks, so some of these are clearly wrong, but they also have lower probability. So these are 3,000 fibers in one voxel. And as you can understand, this is quite expensive to do that in the whole brain. So normally you do this in a region of interest, and if you want to see connectivity between two. Because otherwise it would be like 3,000 times a normal tractography. And here we have done some of this normalization, and can get the low probability of connection. So yellow here is high probability. And then threshold, so we don't, because everything is connected, everything in probability makes sense, but it's a very low probability. Okay, so that was a few words of stochastic. There is much more work out there, and it's also a moving target. It's an interesting direction of work that you're going to see more of. So then the third section here called physically based, and I found it. 2 or 3 examples, and I'm sure there are more out there, but the thinking here is try to connect the data more to a physical model, so that then you can have maybe more, it's easier to know if the results are optimal. So, for example, looking at the diffusion heat equation directly, since the data is diffusion, maybe that's the way to look at the data. You can also do optimal path, it's kind of in between this method. But there is some new work coming out in using the diffusion equation to look at connectivity. Some early work was by Philip Batchelor, and we did something to him too that I want to describe. And there's some new work now with Larry Frank that is coming out looking at the prompt propagation. It's prompt propagation and diffusion is a little bit tricky, because diffusion is really like has infinite speed. I mean, if you drop a drop of something, I mean, and you model as a Gaussian function, this can, in the beginning the Gaussian function is very narrow, but it has infinite spread. I mean, so it kind of touches infinity directly, which is kind of weird, because you want to see this front, and then it's going to be wider and wider, but still the tails are in infinity. So what is the front you want to measure here? So it's, and I think that's the reason we went to it for the steady state instead of looking at this flow. First, it's very slow to estimate how this diffusion is actually propagating, but also what does it mean? Because this front kind of touches everything directly. So the reflection of diffusion, heat, as some most of you, these are the same equation, diffusion and heat equation. So you have a concentration of something, and the gradient of that gives a flow, and you have a scalar factor here that describes how big this flow is. And this is in an isotropic measure. In a non-isotropic measure, you put something else. Normally you have a diffusion tensor here. And so this gradient is going to be transformed through the tensor. And the idea here of connectivity is to integrate this flow vector using the unit times the unit tangent vector along a path. And in this case, it's the solution you do that is on the steady state, so it's not an iterative method. So how do you solve the steady state? We have again the same equation, the gradient of the gradient of the flux, and you put in the anisotropic version of that, which I showed here, division tensor times the gradient of the concentration, and then you set this to zero and solve for this. And what we do here, we use boundary condition as sources and sinks. And here is an example of the sinking source. And if you look at the flow magnitude, you get something like this. We didn't go any further with this because we couldn't really figure out, so what do you do with this? I mean, it's a nice result, but actually, how do you do a study with this? And I think we went more in the direction of this fast Martian ideas and stochastic, but new work is coming up in this kind of direction with diffusion, so this is not the end of it, but we kind of stopped working on that back then because we didn't really know exactly where to go from this result. There's some other physics-based method that is actually performed here, and this is from Nathan Hagman, and this is in Toga's group. And this is some work represented at ESP using the Navier-Stokes equations. As you know, in fluid mechanics, these equations are kind of important to get correct flow. And I haven't seen the paper, but there's a paper coming out now. So Nathan is working with and Toga in this NAMIC, National Alliance for Image, Medical Image Computing. So we have different groups that are doing their own stratigraphy, and we try to compare and contrast them. And you could ask Nathan if you want to know more of this method. Okay, so that was a few words about physics-based. The last area here I wanted to talk about is global model support and atlases. So what is happening in that area? And as we mentioned, the fast matching and this kind of PDE-based methods are global in some sense because they get the optimum. But there are other methods also that look in a, so this support more than local. It's helical support. And I'm going to see if I can explain that. So this is from Kalem Siddiqui's group. Some of you have probably heard about this work. They showed it in ICCV last year, October. This work by Peter Savajev, this is a thesis. What they look here is at flow of frame fields, so they call it generalized helicoids and digital MRI. So if you look at this kind of hypothetical streamlines in the field of tensor, you can have this Fresnel frame that follow that. And if you have bundles that are coherent, you should have all these frames should kind of behave in a similar way. So they cannot do arbitrary things. So they try to characterize these frame fields using some math and using this generalized helicoids, they can get the parametric description of this frame field. And he actually gave a talk about this at the BAMF meeting in 2007. So he took some examples from the audience. So these are not halos, but yeah, so he's looking at streamlined flows here. And this is back when I had longer hair and my ponytail, so I had more of this coherent flow. And Ross Whittaker wasn't very happy about this picture, but these are the shorter fibers. And But the main point here is that you have these dense parallel curves, and using this frame field theory, you can actually describe it with fewer parameters. And this is very interesting for tractography, and they haven't really, I haven't seen results yet, but it's really asking for being incorporated in a tractography method. So I think this is exciting work, and also we have the luck that Peter is coming to us as a postdoc now in next month. So hopefully we can continue some of this work in Boston. But the ideas are using a generalized helicoid as an oscillating object, we can connect the flow pattern and define a parametric distribution of the 3D field. Okay, so that was how you incorporate some local information. Another direction of work is manifold learning, and it mostly be used for post-processing of fibers, like to group them, but they can actually, they could potentially be used in tractography. I mean, if you have coherent fibers, it's more like, I mean, they could support each other. And the idea about here in the manifold learning that you map your fibers to some low-dimensional space, and then you use open spectral methods to define the manifold. And here's an example. This is from Lauren O'Donnell's thesis. She's going to speak this afternoon about this work. And so you have these trace fibers. You find some similarity between them. I mean, we could look at the endpoints. I mean, that's kind of attractive for the cortex, and things that connect in the same place in the cortex, if they are close, maybe it doesn't matter exactly the path they take. You can also look at the mean distance to them, or the minimum, or the different Hausdorff methods. But after you have a metric, and you can define this higher dimensional feature space by doing pairwise distances. And then by clustering, you can then label back this information in the tracks. And this could potentially be done inside the tractography. I mean, we haven't seen that yet, but it would be an expensive way, but it's doable. Here a result, an early result from Hans Brun, one of my students. So this is whole brain clustering, and so these are you have number of tracts here on this matrix number, and then you take the distance between the fibers are kind of the entries in this matrix. It's rearranged based on the eigenvector, so you can actually see clusters here as squares in the diagonal. But more about this afternoon, Lauren and I will talk about this style of work. Other ways to incorporate more global models is to use atlases, and this is a picture of Susan Morris Weisner atlas. I think it's actually available publicly now. And some of this is manually labeled, but some of it you can actually get from tractography and then make boxes. And I think we will see more of using this kind of data inside our method. For example, you cannot have any tracks in the ventricles because we have water there, so we don't have any tracks outside the brain. I mean, we have some very strong kind of priors where tracks can be. And in these atlases, of course, we can maybe include some better tissue models, so we can refer the measurements to the tissue models. But we have to be careful how much prior knowledge we get. So what if we have pathology here? And so we have to be careful how much we believe in the data. And I don't know what's happening. I think this is actually in Moscow somewhere. I found this on the web. I mean, something is happening over here. And cross some tracks, you have to be careful how much you put priors. And a common artifact on pathology we have at Brigham is the brain tumor cases. So this is a brain tumor. And these tumors sometimes displace fibers, sometimes they infiltrate them. So one project is now looking how the fiber tracts actually are behaving close to the tumors. Are they crossing through, and are they intact then, or are they crossing through but the tumor has destroyed them, or they just displayed? And this is very important when you do this, the resection, because some of, especially the motor functions, I mean, if you extend the the life of a patient, maybe a couple of years or 5 years, but the patient cannot move afterwards, it's not really worth it. So maybe it's better to reduce that time, but actually have quality of life. So it's very important which fibers you cut and not cut. So having good displays for this is something that they want. So have you seen any trends in tractography by this overview? My overall kind of view here is that it is a little bit empty down here in the global support and Atlas. I think we're going to see more here. And the question is how we incorporate these global models that are kind of correct anatomically, but also doesn't constrain or to do too much or put too much prior information. We have a lot of things happening in the stochastic area, and it's kind of a debate between different groups what is the better. I mean, the Oxford group is very in favor of stochastics, and I think in my group we have both camps. I mean, some are actually very in strong favor of the geometric ones because they want to know what's happening and don't want to have this kind of diffuse solution. And I think especially for visualization in neurosurgery, I mean, these are actually quite nice, this method, because you don't get these blobby results. And I think one reason we have not really focused or kind of converged to one method is that we haven't really found the killer application of tractography clinically. I mean, this is all very cute and has potential, but we haven't found this application that really would change the way we do care. And when we find those applications, then I guess that would tell us more which of these actually will become the winners, at least in that application. So I think I summarized some of this here. I think one thing we will see is we're going to need to have more advanced sequences. So now we have tensors and Hardy, and you can only do so much with those measurements. And Christoph showed this morning a little bit of the Q-ball imaging, and the Q-space imaging, where actually you get not only one shell, you get data in the full Fourier room. And we might need more of that to actually estimate. And we also need to have some nice tissue models and how to estimate data from this. So I mean, these go together, and they're kind of slowly ramping up here. So there's some nice work happening. And then, as I said, Atlas formation is important, and because we know where the tracks cannot be. And again, stochastic versus deterministic, I think the field is still debating that, so I'm happy with the input from that also. I think with that I stop. Any questions? So I think there are different answers. So here's one reason why we need a better tissue models, because now the tensor model is saying some direction. It's not really connected to the data, and it's not enough to make a really justify kind of decision. We have done some validation. Another has done validation in using histology. So we actually introduced traces in the brain. We did a study with a macaque brain that we did surgery. We introduced some HRP, horseradish peroxide, and that travels through these axons in vivo for, in a couple of days it has reached the different. And what we did the resection of this brain, and we tried to put it together using registration. First you do histology. You cut the slice and you mount it on glass, you do histochemistry, you take pictures with a digital camera, you try to put this together in 3D, you have to fix distortion, and in the end you get something that looks at the tract that you have estimated from histology, but there's so many steps in this procedure, so I mean, should we believe that more than actually the tractography? I mean, I was not really happy with the conclusion. I mean, in the end we can say we have a tract here, it looks like it's the same as the histology. But we couldn't make any stronger kind of connection than that. And if we can find better ways to actually measure in histology what's going on, I think that would help us with these decisions.
In the same line, it's always tempting to estimate as many tracks or to get as much accuracy as you can. And there's always a trade-off in statistics between essentially overfitting and getting real stuff. And so what people would do is introduce, I mean, one of the methods would be introduce some other parameter that gives some coarse versus fine representation of the data and try to optimize it with respect to whatever data, I mean, the amount of data you have and how reliable this is. What would be another parameter for fiber tracks? Is there, has anybody done something like that? What could be?
I don't know, actually. I mean, it's a good question. But are you thinking about like a scale parameter?
Could be a scale. Yeah. Could be, are there some, I don't know, close to fiber, accurate, less accurate, smooth, less smooth fiber tracking that could,
so
which someone could play?
I mean, I think still many of the problems are, I mean, earlier, the methods are not doing exactly what we want. I mean, the data is a little bit noisier or under samples, so you need to have models that we, and then how should you include these models? That could be a parameter, but that's dangerous then to predict the tissue if you don't really know what's going on. I mean, like these Romanian methods that look at the flow, they just examine. I think that they cut corners a little bit more than we want, and so we have to correct that first before we put these kind of fine tuning parameters.
All right, thank you. I think we're going to stop here for the question because we have another talk after, so let's take 5 to 10 minutes break.